again. I know it's contrarian, but please, trust me on this. Throughout this chapter, we'll be using this technique and apply it to goal setting. Stop counting your blessings. You're probably yelling at me by now, but hear me out. Research shows that subtracting your blessings, rather than counting them, is far more effective when you're trying to self-regulate and stop yourself from sliding into an ocean of despair, maintain a level of happiness, or feel grateful. Researchers Min Kyung Koo, Sarah Algo, Timothy Wilson, and Daniel Gilbert, the latter two are gurus on the subject of happiness, asked a simple question. Was it how people thought about a positive event that affected how happy they were and how happiness could be sustained? They posed a question. What if, instead of counting your blessings, you subtracted them? Guess what? In their fourth study, which examined romantic relationships, all of the participants were in relationships they considered satisfying. The researchers had individuals either write about how they met, how they started dating and the like, or write about how they might not have met or ended up together. It was the second task, the exercise of subtraction, that yielded an increase in positive effect. The takeaway. If you're using thinking about the good things in your life to self-regulate, you'll feel happier and experience more gratitude by thinking about what your life would be like without those things or those people. Let go of pleasing and appeasing. No one wants more drama in her life. But if your coping mechanisms include appeasing difficult or toxic people or continuing to try to please them, you have to put those behaviors on hiatus immediately. Historically, appeasement doesn't work for countries and it doesn't work for people either. This is not a call to start a new world war and to engage in open hostilities with all the difficult people in your life, but it is a reminder that you must work on setting boundaries if you're not ready to throw in the towel and simply ban those people from your life. Boundaries are healthy and shouldn't look like mini versions of the Great Wall of China. Begin by thinking about your goals, and then put them down on paper. For example, one of your goals might be to maintain less contact with more civility, or to set forth some rules that would govern your interactions with these folks. Setting boundaries doesn't have to include aggression or anger. In fact, it shouldn't. Although you should prepare yourself for pushback, especially if you are dealing with people who are used to controlling or manipulating you. Please note, if you are living with an abusive person who could do you physical harm, please consult a therapist or counselor before attempting to put boundaries in place. You need to stop pleasing and appeasing at this moment, because acting in this way disappears you, your needs and wants, your feelings and thoughts. These are unhealthy patterns that can get in the way of your growth and development. Stop normalizing abusive or toxic behavior. You might not even be aware that you're reacting to abusive behavior in unhealthy ways, especially if you grew up around abusive people. Take a look at these behaviors that unintentionally fuel the continuation of abuse and see which ones are part of your personal repertoire. The time has come to cull them from your unconscious scripts. Accepting that you're too sensitive. You've heard these words all of your life, and whenever someone says something hurtful, you end up taking responsibility for being hurt, and your pain becomes your problem, not the person's who's wounded you. Similarly, an intimate tells you that you're too serious or that you can't take a joke after he or she has said something that absolutely withers you, and you accept that statement as accurate. Stop right now. On the other hand, if you tend to overreact, practice the stop, look, listen technique so that you can get a handle on what you're bringing to the party. This doesn't mean that you should believe it's your fault, but you should work on finding balance. Context matters. And as you become more confident about identifying those moments when you actually are being too sensitive, it will be much easier to identify the people who are using those words to manipulate and control you. You still don't defend yourself when you're falsely blamed or put down. If you were scapegoated or the daughter of a hypercritical mother, duck and cover may have been your first line of defense during childhood, and you may be very sensitive to any kind of criticism at all. But that needs to stop if you're going to move forward, because you need to be able to tell the difference between criticism that's used as a weapon and critical commentary that is meant to be helpful. Paying attention to a person's language and tone can help you distinguish one kind of criticism from another. Criticism that intends to marginalize you is highly personal, often expressed in sentences that begin with "you always" or "you never," which are then followed by a laundry list of your flaws. The criticism is never limited to something specific, but spins into generalized statements about your character, such as, "you always forget to do what you've been asked to do because you're selfish and unmotivated by nature." Criticism that is meant to be constructive is specific, offered as a suggestion, and is usually part of a dialogue. "I think there were ways you might have handled that blow-up with him differently, such as explaining why it's so frustrating." Or, "it would be better if you didn't get defensive, because that leads to escalating the tension." You still rationalize when you're stonewalled. Children who are ignored or made to feel invisible in childhood often have trouble recognizing what psychologists know to be the most toxic pattern in relationships and a sure sign of trouble: demand, withdraw. The unloved daughter tends to tolerate stonewalling precisely because it's so familiar to her, and to rationalize her partner's behavior by thinking that he's simply too stressed to talk things through, to blame herself for choosing the wrong time or tone to initiate a discussion, or to castigate herself for making a demand in the first place. This kind of tolerance just adds to an already unhealthy dynamic. Stonewalling is never an appropriate response. You still question your perceptions. Children who are mocked, marginalized, or gaslighted in their families of origin don't just suffer from low self-esteem. They're also quick to retreat when challenged because they're deeply insecure about whether their perceptions are valid and to be trusted. Second-guessing themselves is the default behavior. Gaslighting can make a child deeply fearful, as I was, especially of being crazy or damaged in some profound way. This, again, cedes all power to the narcissist or manipulator who needs to control you. That ends the list of the behaviors you need to give up. Now, we'll shift our attention to the behaviors and skills you want to master and acquire. Strategies for skillful emotional management. Whether you cope with negative feelings by pushing off from them or getting utterly swept up in them, it's clear that you will need a new set of skills to finally move out of that childhood bedroom that's been replicated in your head. Becoming emotionally resilient is the goal here, so that you can weather the crises life throws at you, whether a minor setback or something major like a job loss, the illness of a loved one, a breakup or divorce, or anything else disruptive, and become adept at setting new goals for yourself and achieving them. It's the antidote to being stuck. These strategies can be used alone or in combination. You will have to see which ones work best for you. In the thick of it, naming your feelings. Putting your feelings into words is the basis of talk therapy, of course, and as we've already explored, being able to label and identify your emotions precisely is a key component of emotional intelligence. A study conducted by Matthew Lieberman and others showed, via MRI imaging, that naming emotions actually decreased activity in the amygdala, the more primitive part of the brain where emotions are stored and where reactivity begins, and increased activity in the prefrontal cortex, the part of the brain where thinking and executive control take place. This means there's a strategy that permits you to exert control and manage your feelings. Knowing what you're feeling, distinguishing anxiety from fear, shame from anger, etc., allows you to tamp down the emotionality your amygdala is fueling and have access to the thinking part of your brain instead. That access lets you assess and understand the situation using reasoning. I am anxious because he's acting out of character. I am scared because this reminds me of my childhood. I feel shame because she's right about my overreaction. I am angry because her tone is nasty and bullying. I feel threatened by his tone. This type of thinking permits you to exert some initial control over your emotional responses and opens the door to being able to manage your feelings in the moment. Using cognitive reappraisal. We've already heard that suppressing negative emotions and thoughts is a flawed strategy that only increases rumination and anxiety, because when you try not to think of a white bear, you can think of nothing else. But science suggests that one helpful tactic is what's called cognitive reappraisal. Let's say you're in a really stressful situation, about to be interviewed for a big job opportunity, or in the middle of a fight with someone you really care about, and you are just flooded with emotion. What can you do? You pull back and you mentally reappraise the situation as being less threatening than it appears. You remind yourself that this job isn't a make-or-break situation. There will be other opportunities after this one, and the world's not going to end if you don't get it. Or that the person you're arguing with looks tired and stressed too, and this can be diffused with some effort without your totally losing it. Cognitive reappraisal allows you to cool down your emotions. Think of it as taking a deep breath, but with your mind, and calm down enough to start sorting through them. Getting a handle on why you are feeling what you're feeling requires cognition and applies the brakes to the way your emotions are hijacking your brain. It allows you to get back into the driver's seat. So, is cognitive reappraisal as effective as naming emotions? It turns out, it isn't. That was shown by an experiment by Katharina Kurkansky, Matthew D. Lieberman, and others that looked at the comparative usefulness of labeling your emotions, cognitive reappraisal, and distraction with a group of participants who suffered from arachnophobia, an acute fear of spiders. They did so by having the participants approach a Chilean rose-haired tarantula, which had a 6-inch leg span, in the pretest. No, the number of inches is not a typo, and you could not have paid me to be a participant. They began 5 feet away from the spider at first, were instructed to approach it continuously, and then, at the last step, were instructed to touch the spider with the tip of their index finger. Then, in a subsequent test, they were exposed to a different spider, but one just as large, and were randomly assigned to use effect labeling. I feel anxious the disgusting spider will jump on me. Reappraisal. Looking at the little spider isn't dangerous. Distraction. Looking at furniture instead of the spider. Or given no verbal instruction at all while they looked at the spider. The strength of their emotions was measured by skin conductance response. Skin becomes a better conductor of electricity when something happens that is psychologically arousing, and arousal is part of emotional response. The researchers found that naming and labeling emotions reduced the skin conductance response more than other techniques. That said, effect labeling did not offer an advantage when it came to self-reported fear, which was described after each test. So while cognitive reappraisal should be part of your emotional toolkit, naming emotions remains the go-to strategy. Mindfulness. Yes, this has become a buzzword of sorts and is very much in vogue, but it has science to back up its usefulness. You may have read magazine articles or books about mindfulness and meditation as an approach to life, a concept drawn from Buddhism. But let's take a look at what it means in terms of emotional regulation. Being mindful means that you are intentionally and exclusively focused on ongoing sensory, cognitive, and emotional experience without judging it or elaborating on it. It's total awareness with acceptance. Studies show that mindfulness reduces stress, stimulates positive emotions, producing joy and tranquility, among other feelings, and increases cognitive flexibility. These are all very good reasons to reach for a yoga mat. But I'm going to offer a demural here, however. At the end of your journey, mindfulness may be a good technique to manage emotions and maintain emotional equilibrium, but it's not likely to be an effective one if you are still working through identifying your reactions and your basic attachment style. It will surprise no one that, despite the benefits mindfulness bestows on people, it comes relatively easily to the securely attached. They're better equipped to accept and have compassion for themselves, and is problematic for the insecurely attached. Why is that? Because the strategies that the insecurely attached use, pushing off from emotion and suppressing distressing thoughts for the avoidant, and desperately trying to maintain connection with a cascade of anxiety for the anxious, preoccupied individual, diminish the capacity for mindfulness. The ways insecurely attached people have of coping make it very hard for them to be open, aware, and non-judgmental, which lie at the heart of mindfulness. That was shown in an experiment by John G. Caldwell and Philip R. Shaver, who hypothesized that the deactivating strategy of avoidance and the hyperactivating strategy of the anxiously attached predicated lower levels of mindfulness, and found exactly that. But, having made that discovery, the same researchers set out to examine whether mindfulness could, in fact, improve the regulation of emotion in insecurely attached women. It turned out that the experiment's participants, who were part of a 3-day intensive program, 8 hours a day, with focus on exercises, understanding of both mindfulness and attachment, guided meditation with images of secure attachment, writing and discussion of unhealthy attachment scripts, and more, showed significant improvements in rumination, emotional clarity, emotional regulation, and mindfulness. This seems to suggest that initial intensive training is actually necessary for the unloved daughter to make use of mindfulness as a self-help regulatory technique. Keep in mind, as you get further along in the journey, taking classes might be a good idea too. Shutting down the critical tape. As studies show, self-criticism is often the result of a child internalizing the harsh and abusive verbal assessments of a mother, but it might be a father or siblings as well. It also grows from the messages conveyed by both actions and inactions, hostile encounters, or withheld comfort or support. Unloved daughters with verbally aggressive mothers often report, and I can attest to this from my own experience, that shutting off the tape loop of self-criticism in your head is surprisingly difficult, even with a therapist's help. Among the legacies unloving mothers bequeath is the unhealthy default setting of self-blame when life goes south, made worse by the fact that insecurely attached daughters have difficulty regulating their emotions. What to do about uprooting and silencing the critical voice? This is, anecdotally at least, one of the hardest things to learn. Following are some strategies for you to consider. Recognize the voice. Bring your thoughts into consciousness and make them explicit. Say them out loud. Write them down. Realize that the voice is that of a person who didn't love you. She is an interloper. challenge the voice and the thoughts. Giving voice to the internalized words, and even writing them down so you can see them in black and white, make it clear that they only have power because you believed them to be true as a child. Argue with what was said, pointing out that you're neither stupid nor lazy, not a burden or a bother, or whatever untruths were pounded into your head. Say the words out loud if you are alone. Countermand the voice with facts. These old habits of self-criticism pop up when you're feeling down and stressed because you've experienced a setback, rejection, or have failed at something. Disarm your reactivity by identifying your emotions or using cognitive reappraisal first. Then, sit down and analyze why the stressful event happened. Writing down alternatives to the automatic response of self-criticism may give you more of a handle on silencing it, especially if you're able to take responsibility for your mistakes without devolving into self-criticism. Let's say that someone has broken up with you, ending a friendship or intimate relationship, and the default settings in your head are telling you that you're unlovable, lacking in charm, and unattractive. Take on the voice by seeing what happened as a neutral observer might. For example, the relationship ended because I chose someone who did not listen and probably didn't want to be in a close relationship with me under any circumstances. It had nothing to do with my failings or my appeal. It had everything to do with the fact that I chose the wrong person. Learning to accept both your strengths and your weaknesses and seeing setbacks as part of life are essential to your healing. Practice self-talk. Remind yourself of your own strengths and talents, which your mother and perhaps the rest of your family ignored, scoffed at, or marginalized. My own mother, who was self-conscious and worried about how smart she was, always denigrated my academic achievements, except when she could brag about them to her social circle. Write them down and put the list somewhere you see it every day and read it aloud. If you're having trouble coming up with a list, ask a friend or intimate to tell you what she or he admires about you. Remember that what you internalized was meant to make you feel small and lousy about yourself. Examine your beliefs about the self. Do you believe that personality, yours and anyone else's, is inborn and fixed? Or do you believe that people are actually capable of growing and changing in meaningful ways? This sounds like a philosophical question, but it isn't, because your beliefs can enhance or diminish your sense of self and influence your behaviors, as the work of Carol Dweck has shown. Think about your beliefs carefully. If you actually believe that personality is set in stone, silencing that critical voice will be next to impossible because your belief gives what was said to you in childhood a boost of credibility. According to Dweck, our theories about the self influence not just how we respond to specific situations, but also how we process and think about them. So, spend some real time asking yourself whether you believe that personality is fixed or malleable and capable of change before you continue listening. Think about your attitudes toward yourself, your personality and traits, as well as those of others. Dweck notes that people who believe that personality can change confront challenges confidently, stick to difficult tasks, and bounce back from failure more easily. Your beliefs and dealing with rejection. In an interesting bit of research, Lauren Howe and Carol Dweck discovered that people who embrace the idea that personality is fixed have more trouble recovering from rejection than those who see personality as fluid and changeable. The reason, as they write, is that these people see rejection as revealing a core truth about themselves, and that prolongs their suffering. The people who believe that personality and character are fixed are unlikely to believe that they can grow and learn from rejection, and the researchers found that some people actually still had lingering pain as long as 5 years after the rejection took place. Many actually want to edit the failed relationships out of their history, believing that anyone who knew the story would somehow be encouraged to reject them too. Do you recognize this pattern in yourself? It's an important question to ponder. This is how Carol, 51, answered. I'd like to believe that I can change, but then I look at all the failed relationships in my life, and I wonder. I'm starting to see that I'm actually driving people away with my need for reassurance and always looking over my shoulder in fear. If I can't fix that part, I think real change is going to be impossible. I answer that by saying that what was learned can be unlearned, and despairing of change is not just unproductive, but incorrect. Unlearning is hard, to be sure, but definitely possible. Turn down the heat, dealing with rejection sensitivity. One of the best discussions of rejection sensitivity I've read describes it as hot reactivity, which is completely emotionally fueled. Yes, this is the same terminology used in the discussion on how to reframe memories using cool processing. Aslam Eduk and a team that included Walter Mischel, who ran the famous delayed gratification marshmallow test described earlier, wanted to know if children who had successfully been able to delay gratification would actually be more skilled at managing rejection sensitivity. You may remember that the children who managed to resist the marshmallow did so by distracting themselves, looking away, singing, staring into the distance, whatever worked. The researchers suggest that people high in rejection sensitivity can also use strategic rerouting of attention, away from those cues that are clanging, rejection imminent, arm yourself, and instead pay attention to situational cues that contradict the rejection sensitivity, such as appreciating body language, he's smiling at me, so why am I panicking, and tone of voice, and be able to take cognitive control. Note that this is a deliberate cooling strategy, which is different from thought suppression. As we know, thought suppression only serves to jumpstart the brain to search for the thoughts you're trying to tamp down and ends in a ruminative loop, as Daniel Wegener's white bear experiment showed. Learning to cool down consciously and with effort works. Become fluent in the language of self-compassion. It's been suggested by many that self-compassion is a successful strategy for those trying to recover from childhood and who need help stilling that critical voice. Additionally, self-compassion has been shown in studies to bolster resilience from failure and to support self-improvement. What is self-compassion, exactly? Just as compassion involves feeling for the plight of others and extending caring and understanding to them, self-compassion directs caring toward the self in the same way. According to researcher Kristin Neff, self-compassion requires that you see your pain in the larger context of humanity's experiences and as a part of them. It necessitates that you treat yourself with the same loving kindness your compassion itself would offer to others. This understanding is drawn from Buddhism, as you probably know. What's important is that self-compassion isn't anything like self-pity, because self-pity focuses on the self as separate from others and promotes a poor me point of view that paints the self as worse off than anyone else. Self-pity is more self-involved and selfish than not. Self-compassion also doesn't involve self-aggrandizement or puffing yourself up to make yourself feel more important, because that stance, too, sees the self as separate. Self-compassion is displaying empathy toward yourself and your experiences. Neff describes self-compassion as having three parts, which I'll paraphrase. Extending kindness and understanding to yourself rather than judgmental criticism. seeing your experience as part of the larger human experience, keeping yourself aware of your painful feelings without over-identifying with them. The problem, though, is that all three of these steps are hard for most of you. If they're not, skip this part. I'm troubleshooting for those who struggle with self-compassion. The reasons why self-compassion is difficult aren't hard to see. The first step relies on self-love and self-esteem, which are usually in short supply, and if you're used to being self-critical, it's not likely that you'll be non-judgmental when it comes to assessing yourself. The second is complicated, too, because most unloved daughters feel isolated and singular and aren't likely to believe that their problems are like those of most other people. The third step, as we've already acknowledged, also presents a hurdle, since you have to be able to manage negative emotions first in order to achieve that equanimity and balance. That said, self-compassion can be learned and accomplished. Since research shows that self-compassion really does help people deal with challenging times and stops rumination, another thing most unloved daughters suffer from, how do we build our capacity so we can use it to still the critical voice? Here are a few anecdotal layperson tips, slightly aided by science, but informed by experience, which may be of help on the road to self-compassion. As you do these, be sure to use cool processing, which has you recalling why you felt as you did, not what you felt. Get a photograph of yourself when you were little and spend some time with it. Look at that child, you, and see her as a stranger might. What's cute and appealing about her? Talk to that little girl and give her some comfort and recognize how lonely and sad she was. And while you're there, ask yourself why anyone would ever think that child was anything less than adorable. I've had hundreds of people on my Facebook page do this exercise, and not one has found her childhood self less than utterly endearing. It's fruitful, too, to look at photographs of yourself in late childhood or adolescence. Try as I might, when I looked through photographs, I was unable to see the fat girl my mother saw or the supremely difficult one she described 24/7. Again, look at you as a stranger might, and remember what she really was like back then, what she liked doing, the books she read, what made her laugh, what she dreamed of, what she yearned for. Getting to know our younger selves in this way supports feeling compassion for ourselves. Focus on at least three things you love about you. They can be characteristics or talents or abilities, but they need to be things that make you happy that you are you. Cast a wide net as you think about yourself in this way, because you may discover that some of the best things about you aren't big things, but small details. For example, it might be the way you can put people at ease, or your ability to raid the fridge and create a meal. It doesn't have to be something grandiose like playing Wimbledon, writing a bestseller, or running a major corporation. You can love your hair, the way you transplant seedlings, how you make your child laugh, or the fact that you're kick-ass at your job. If you're stumped, ask a friend or another intimate to help you. The critical voice reduces you to a series of negatives that help your parent marginalize or control you. Having self-compassion permits you to add in all the other things her characterizations missed. Make a drawing, create a collage, or build an altar symbolizing your strengths. This may sound very New Agey to some of you, but expressing yourself in another medium can clarify and strengthen your intentions, and requires a different kind of thinking and permits you to see yourself in a different way. If you can't draw, write down words that describe your best you. Steadfast, capable, loyal, good cook, expert knitter. And download images or cut out photographs from magazines to create a positive portrait of yourself. Alternatively, you can create an altar. Yes, this is very New Age, but I once wrote a book about it. By assembling objects and images that summon up your gifts or what you love or your favorite pursuits, gather them on a shelf, table, or windowsill, and use the grouping as a visual reminder of what's good about you. You can also build an altar to signify your intention by using symbols of growth and possibility. Anything green, a butterfly because of its metamorphosis, seeds or pine cones, a photo of a lotus, for example, along with words that inspire you to action. Make self-compassion a goal. We will be talking more about goal setting, but you can work up to being self-compassionate as you would any other goal, just as saving money, cleaning out your closets, or finding a new job. Write your goal down and come up with steps to accomplish it. Here are some possible statements you could make. I won't be as hard on myself when things go wrong. Everyone screws up some of the time. I have to put my mistakes in context and have a better perspective on them. They're not proof I'm worthless. When someone criticizes me, I have to ground myself and listen, and then ground myself again. Is there something to be learned from what he or she is saying, or should I just discard it? When you find yourself falling into the old default position of self-criticism, call it out and argue with it, and then move your mind into a self-compassionate place. Keep notes on the progress you're making by not reverting to that self-critical point of view, and treat yourself to something you like when you succeed. Yes, it's called positive reinforcement. Ask yourself, will I show myself compassion? Write the question down and pin it up where you can see it. Remind yourself that this is a step-by-step process and that baby steps are fine. But that next time you experience a setback or are down in the dumps about all that you're not, you will show yourself some compassion instead of joining the old critical chorus. Goal setting and self-inventory. Rather than simply being hopeful about changing your life, how you connect to others, and how you feel about yourself, you need to stop being vague and get some concrete goals. Science actually knows a lot about goal setting. There's been lots of research, and which factors play a role in whether a goal can be met. You can set goals in any area of your life, personal strivings, relationship or work, and career. Here are some useful strategies, many of them adapted from my book, Quitting, Why We Fear It and Why We Shouldn't, in Life, Love, and Work. Write your goals down. Studies show that writing them down makes your thinking more concrete and helps motivation, too. And while you can type your goals, you engage different parts of your brain when you handwrite, so grab a pen. It's also very helpful to think about your goals in both the short term and the long term because it helps you stay balanced in terms of your realism and your optimism about your progress. For example, your short-term goal might be to reduce your anxiety by exercising, using visualization, and working on managing your emotions more proficiently by paying attention to triggers. Your long-term goal might be to increase the level of intimacy in your relationships by being less anxious about trusting others. Make sure your goals and abilities are in sync. Common wisdom has it that the higher the bar, the better the jump, but that happens not to be true for everyone. First, make sure the goal you're setting is feasible. Ask yourself whether it's something you can actually accomplish in the time frame you're considering. Do you need to set an interim goal, or should you lower your expectations, at least to begin with? Use writing to clarify both your intentions and your plans. This is very important if you've avoided making mistakes or the possibility of failure most of your life. Secure people expect glitches to happen and plan for them, which makes them more resilient and able to recover from setbacks faster. So examine your goals carefully. The work of Gabriella Oettingen and her colleagues underscored that how you think about achieving goals directly affects your motivation. At one end of the spectrum is what they called indulging, painting a totally rosy picture of what your future will be like when you've achieved the goal and returning to it again and again in your imagination, embroidering it with details. An indulging train of thought would sound like this: I will change myself so much that I'll be able to find a partner and live happily ever after. Or, I will so wow my bosses that they'll give me a promotion and double my salary. Or, I'll just write a novel and it will become a huge bestseller and I'll be rich. At its worst, indulging is no different from pipe dreaming. At the other end is what they call dwelling, being so fixed on your current negative circumstances that you can only come up with visions of defeat if you try to change. Neither of these thought processes motivates you to actually achieve the goal. The solution to effective goal setting is what Oettingen calls mental contrasting. Using mental contrasting. Mental contrasting requires you to keep in mind, at the same time, both your goal and the future you will enjoy if you attain it, and the real-life issues that could get in the way of your achieving it. Having both the positive vision and the proactive problem-solving stance in your head simultaneously gets you to a Goldilocks place of just right, the correct mix of optimism with healthy realism. Let's say that your goal is to get closer to someone you like, but someone you're always locking horns with. You realize you've been overly reactive, so you're going to focus on modulating your responses, and you can envision how much better the relationship will be. But you balance that positive vision with the recognition that she is pretty reactive herself, so you're going to come up with strategies to keep the conversation going if things go off track. That's where if-then thinking comes in. One caveat about mental contrasting. Researchers using brain imaging have located the parts of the brain in which mental contrasting takes place, specifically those associated with working memory and intention. They are different from those activated by indulging. This led them to surmise that mental contrasting taxes working memory, which is a limited resource. So they suggest you try not to use mental contrasting when you're thinking about other things or are stressed or tired. Keep that in mind. Being prepared. The power of if-then thinking. The Boy Scout motto, "Be prepared," is a good one. And while if-then thinking won't help you determine which way is north and won't start a campfire, it's a game-changer nonetheless, and needs to be used to bolster mental contrasting. Preparing for the stumble, the glitch, the setback, or even an unanticipated change in the script is an important and empowering skill. Basically, it's really thinking about Plan B when you're still focused on Plan A. If X happens, then I will do Y. If-then thinking both permits you to plan and enables emotional and intellectual flexibility. You can prepare if-then strategies by journaling and planning out on paper if that works better for you than simply thinking about them. Using this approach won't just increase your flexibility, but will also decrease worry and anxiety because it gets you past thinking about just a single Plan A, but forward to Plans B and C, thus allowing you to roll with the punches if need be. This is especially useful for those women who worry excessively about failing or who still struggle with rejection sensitivity. Substituting approach for avoidance. Once you've recognized that you're motivated by avoidance, you tend to dodge tough conversations, worry too much about failing, so stay in place, default to pleasing or appeasing instead of speaking up. You have to become your own best cheerleader. Once again, concentrate on disarming your default positions by reminding yourself of their origins and how they undermine your true strengths and abilities. Studies show that parents transmit a fear of failure to their children, which is hardly surprising if you think about it. If your parent defines and loves you for what you do and not who you are going to be filled with terror at letting her or him down and being shut out. Remind yourself that while avoidance is safe, it also keeps you stuck in place. Take a leaf out of the securely attached person's book and remind yourself that a setback or even a failure isn't proof of your worthlessness. It's a call to regroup. Use all the tools at your disposal. Reappraisal, self-talk, self-compassion, and mental contrasting if there's a bump in the road. Learning to let go. You've heard the saying, quitters never win and winners never quit, haven't you? Well, guess what? It's not true. It's ironic that the culture focuses solely on the virtues of grit and persistence, because the reality is that humans are far more likely to keep trying and stay long past the expiration date in all manner of situations that are unhealthy and unhappy-making than they are to leave the party too early. That's generally true of everyone, but it's especially true for the unloved daughter. Securely attached people acknowledge the possibility of setbacks and even failure when they set goals, because they believe the self is malleable and capable of growth. They don't see failure as proof positive of some core and immutable flaw in themselves. This isn't to say that failing doesn't smart. It does. But they don't go down for the count. The insecurely attached daughter has to work at letting go, because until she reclaims her authentic self completely and adopts new goals and ways of managing feelings, she's likely to revert to the default settings bequeathed by childhood, willing to do anything to avoid looking as though she's failed in a public way. Even when she's decided that bailing out is what she needs to do, she may hesitate because she's plagued by self-doubt and ends up staying the course once again. Bring your beliefs and thoughts about failure and the self into full conscious awareness for clarity. Recognize that letting go of what's not working in your life isn't a sign of inadequacy, but an indication of your willingness to head off in a new direction. You're just decluttering for a season of rebirth, which isn't unlike what you do to your closets when the seasons change, only on a larger scale. In this context, the ability to quit without regret and with confidence is a major sign of progress. Revisiting visualization. We've discussed using visualization and other cognitive techniques to help you tear down the walls that keep you in an avoidant lockstep, or, alternatively, to help you stop the emotional flooding that keeps you on an ever-turning carousel without balance. Continue to work on developing and strengthening this skill set as you move toward the next stage of redirecting your life. The more you work at calming yourself down in times of stress, the more these strategies will pay out. Keep in mind that securely attached people do this unconsciously, bringing up images of love and support when they're anxious, remembering positive experiences when they're stressed, and over time, this can become a habit for you, too. Next up are the steps you'll need to take to redirect your life, should you choose to. You may find it useful to return to this chapter and review it if some of these old habits are still getting in your way. Chapter 8. Redirecting Your Life. Making Choices. It was only when I realized that I could be free of her influence that I became free and started my life over. Can you imagine? I was 42 and the mother of two boys. I actually considered giving myself a new first name. That's how reborn I felt. Christy. With newly recovered personal power and belief in the self comes the hard part. Redirecting your intent and energy and deciding what changes you need to make in your life to be happier and more fulfilled. This part of the journey isn't as painful as the stages of discovery and distinguishing, with their truths to be faced, or as emotionally strenuous as disarming and reclaiming, but it does test your newfound trust in yourself. Redirecting your life requires having faith in your own recognitions, trusting your own perceptions, and believing that growth and change are possible. If you are wondering whether you're ready, remind yourself that feeling unsure in the moment is part of the process. Progress remains one baby step at a time, and sometimes two steps back. Redirection and agency. One of the psychological shifts you need to make at this stage, if you haven't before, is seeing yourself as having the agency to effect change and take charge. This will be an important transition for those daughters who have lived their lives listening to others or reacting to situations curated by other people, or who have unwittingly recreated their childhoods in their closest personal relationships and have felt powerless. One of the key choices, and inevitably tied to other decisions you feel you need to make, is how to manage your relationship to your mother. We'll examine the possibilities open to you without giving advice. While there are commonalities, each daughter's situation is unique and individual to her. Only you can decide what you need to do because only you understand what the situation is from the inside out. You alone will live with the consequences of your decisions, even though their effect will be felt by others. This isn't the only choice you'll make, of course, but it's the one that needs to be dealt with first, one way or another. Asking whether the maternal relationship can be salvaged. As we know, the core conflict isn't resolved by reaching adulthood. It continues to be a war between the hardwired need for maternal love and support, as well as a sense of belonging on the one hand, and the daughter's growing rational understanding of how toxic the connection is and her need for some stress-free normalcy on the other. The battle between those two opposed needs can go on for years. In fact, the conflict can continue even if the daughter chooses to divorce her mother. How counterintuitive is that? Because the culture sides with the mother, buying into the mythology that all mothers are loving because nurturing the young is instinctual and puts the daughter on trial, the struggle has a public face in addition to a private one. For the first 18 years of her life, the daughter has no choice but to deal with her mother, no matter what. While getting out of her childhood home is freeing in one sense, it's not a magic bullet. Her wounding isn't salved by independence, and her longing for the stability and comfort she needs continues. In the redirection stage, the daughter has to decide whether to try to save some kind of relationship from the wreckage or to cut bait. Neither choice, by the way, is made in the spur of the moment, but is usually preceded by years of thinking about and going back and forth between the two alternatives. I call that going back to the well, because even though the daughter knows intellectually that the well is dry, her impulse is to try just one more time, just in case. Having waged this particular battle myself over 2 decades when I was a young woman, from my 20s through my 30s to be exact, I understand how much is at stake. On the one hand, there's the tantalizing and ever-hopeful possibility of a reconciliation, accompanied by some long-wished-for recognition by the mother that her daughter really is lovable. Yes, cue the violins for the Hollywood ending. Alas, this is almost always a pipe dream. But many daughters, daunted by the cultural onus of going no contact and the emotional losses involved, are motivated to try to keep the relationship intact in some way, however imperfect it is. Social pressure is also a factor, as is the daughter's fear of making a mistake and of denying her children an extended family. Keep in mind that the decision to divorce your mother inevitably leads to estrangement with other members of your family as well. We'll look at the fallout separately, because it's a huge issue. Trying to salvage the relationship for most is like navigating an obstacle course. If you try it and fail, do not blame yourself. Understanding the obstacle course. You have no idea how long I've tried to fix this, or how many different ways I've tried. I've tried and tried. But I can't. I just can't. Melanie, 45. Some daughters choose to keep the relationship going even though it involves maintaining the painful status quo. One daughter explained it by saying, "For me, I chose to salvage my relationship with her because I know beyond the shadow of a doubt that my mother tried the best she knew how, but she was crippled by the cycle of violence from her mom and her grandmother. I know some daughters don't have that assurance, though." But when questioned, she admitted that the going wasn't smooth. "It depends on the day. There are still unhealthy boundaries, but what helps is having better coping mechanisms. I developed a support system completely outside of my family." When I asked her whether the exchanges were still hurtful, she replied, "It hurts, but I also worry about regretting not having anything to do with her before she dies. Fear is a terrible motivator. But I chose to keep her at arm's length. I pity her." But the obstacles, despite a daughter's best efforts, often remain, and you need to recognize that your ability to remove or sidestep them is usually very limited. Among the most common roadblocks are lack of acknowledgement or plain denial on the mother's part. Salvaging the relationship has to be a dyadic process with the full involvement of both the mother and daughter. Unfortunately, that's not always the case, as one daughter commented. "I'm in awe of people who can continue to have a relationship with their narcissistic mothers. I, for one, couldn't do it. I've been no contact for almost 10 years, even though she lives across the street. Yes, she followed me here. What kind of madness is that? But I'm just not strong enough to handle that abuse every day, and my fear is that she'd poison my daughter against me." Her mother's unwillingness to own her behavior became the linchpin for another daughter in her own middle age. "At the age of 50, I asked myself, how long was I going to beg for my mother's love, or for an apology, or even an acknowledgement of what went on? I gave that up and mourned the loss of my childhood and of the mother I never really had. I felt that, at 50, it had become pathetic. Pathetic that I allowed myself to chase after that for half of my life. If your mother is willing to see a therapist with you, it's worth trying. But be prepared for the possibility that she'll take over the session or sessions and try to win the counselor to her side. The truth? Your mother has to want reconciliation as much as you do. If she doesn't, the effort will inevitably fail. Refusal to respect boundaries. Maintaining boundaries while trying to save the relationship is often a huge struggle, since combative, dismissive, self-involved, controlling, and enmeshed mothers have never observed boundaries and believe that motherhood confers the right to intrude whenever and however. This led one daughter to remark wryly, "All relationships can be salvaged. But at what cost? Some of us aren't willing to pay and pay and pay and pay." Setting boundaries inspires some women to go low contact, with few in-person get-togethers and limited communication, but alas, that's often difficult to maintain. One woman wrote, "My mother is as convinced of her right to intrude on my privacy and to meddle in my affairs as she was when I was 12. Never mind that I'm 45 and the mother of 3. She just doesn't get it. She orchestrates drama all the time, and frankly, it's intolerable. This isn't working." Mothers who have never respected boundaries are very unlikely to start now. Continued verbal aggression, abuse, manipulation, and game playing. Alas, without acknowledgement and therapeutic intervention, mothers tend to keep acting as they always have, despite the daughter's efforts to develop new scripts. Ellie reported, with not a little bit of sadness and resignation. I have tried a low-contact relationship with my mother for over a year. She continued to be manipulative, toxic, and would do things to try and drive a wedge between my husband and me. I felt re-traumatized every time I had to deal with her, either in person or through texting. I made